Hello there. My name is Chris Cook and welcome to TW Talks, the interviews podcast from Free Weeks Edinburgh. We are at Edinburgh Festival 2024, sitting in the lounge at Assembly George Square, right next to the club bar and all the studio venues. The festival is very much happening around us as we speak, and I am chatting to comedians who are performing at this year's Fringe. Today, James Barr, the Hits radio presenter, one half of the podcast A Gay and a Non-Gay, plus stand-up comedian whose show this year is called Sorry I Hurt Your Son, Said My Ex to My Mum. We are going to talk past, present and future, the story so far, this year's show and what is happening next. Okay, I am here back in a sneaky little corner of Assembly George Square, interviewing performers who are appearing at the Fringe this year. My next guest is with me. So James Barr has joined me. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris.
Here on this, I was going to say what day of the week it was, and now I realise it's the middle of the Fringe.
I don't think we observe days of the week at the Fringe. That's no. Actually very deeply homophobic.
Actually, it's Wednesday. The reason I know it's Wednesday is one of the shows I wanted to see this evening is none, because they're taking a Wednesday off.
Of course.
Who knew taking Wednesday off was
people
something?
Are taking sneaky days off this year.
Because in my head,
sneaky days off.
Monday, maybe Tuesday was a day off. Wednesday.
I have Monday off and it took the wind out of my sails, but I'm back now.
There is, my colleague Caro has a theory that yes, the first Monday of what they call week two, second week of the Fringe, a lot of people take that off. And my colleague Caro has a theory is that's when the dreaded Fringe flu kicks in.
Right.
Because for 10 days, everyone's just been living on momentum.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Well, if my flu is crying, then it definitely kicked in. It definitely kicked in.
Well, maybe that's now one of the symptoms in the post-COVID era.
Maybe.
Of Fringe flu. So thank you for joining us. We're going to have a very quick conversation, past, present, future. So we will definitely talk about this year's show.
Amazing.
That's really why we're here. But before we get to this year's show, let me talk you through your career in comedy so far. In about 6-7 minutes. So, edited highlights. So, when did you decide that performing comedy was something that you wanted to do?
So, to answer that, I have to tell you about my career in radio because I was working on the radio a lot when I was younger. I mean, I always wanted to be a comedian, but everyone said I wasn't funny. So, I somehow believed them because I don't know why I thought Derek Bell at my school had any kind of idea on critiquing comedy.
So where could you go and talk and not be funny?
Exactly.
Radio.
The radio. The radio. I mean, that's what we hear every day on the radio, right? So I started doing radio and I was doing it at the hospital. And then I was working for some small radio stations. And eventually I built that career and I ended up at Capital FM in London. And when I was there, and also other radio stations throughout my career at this point, I was told that I was too gay or that I was too creative and that I was trying to be too funny or that things they didn't enjoy. They want, sometimes radio stations just want you to be a voice on a stick. And it's like a Coca-Cola, right? When you drink it, you get the same drink every time. And I'm not a Coca-Cola. I'm a Lucozade. And so I didn't fit. And I ended up losing my job there. So I quit radio for a bit, and that is when I started improv comedy, because in improv comedy, of course, you can be as crazy as you like.
That's the remit. And I guess, so I'm trying to, approximately what dates were you sort of in the world of commercial radio?
So I'm still in it now, I'm back, but I was doing that, was up until 2013.
Yeah.
So 2013 is the
and
moment.
I guess, because I guess the 2000s was an era where a lot of people working in commercial radio, it did, perhaps exception of The Breakfast Show, which is what everyone cares about, it became quite formulaic, didn't it?
Yes, very
Whereas
much
maybe,
so.
I don't know, maybe it's being old now. If you go back to the 70s and the 80s and the early days of even a station like Capital Radio, the presenters had a lot of freedom between the music to be themselves.
Of course.
Rather than, this is what you say, you press this button. So I guess you were too late for that era.
I was slightly too late for that, yeah. And also slightly too early for podcasts, which obviously
has
took
reinvented
over.
The form.
It has completely. Yeah. And now I have my own podcast and I love it because the freedom there is just like, it really connects a gay and a non-gay, if you fancy listening to it. So I started comedy in 2013. I did improv for a couple of years just to get out of my insecurities, I think, and to feel less nervous on stage and to be as camp as I liked.
And was that within a group?
Yeah, I was in multiple different groups.
Yeah.
Obviously, all of them have fallen apart. And I trained with the Free Association. I went to New York and I did a UCB 101. And at that point, that was like an enormous thing to do. UCB was the kind of king and queen of improv schools. So yeah, I trained there, and then I started doing stand-up because I realized that that's what I've always wanted to do. And improv was difficult because it was just lots of different people, and you're relying on other people to be there. So I decided I wanted to do stand-up, so I did a course in London.
And did you feel doing the improv stuff, both in terms of the creativity side, in terms of, you know, playing with the form and coming up with the material, and then also just, I guess, in terms of the having that network and understanding how the business works?
Absolutely.
That once you decided stand-ups for me, you were able to build on both of those.
I think everyone that's in stand-up should do improv, like, just for a bit, or at least everyone starting out in stand-up should do it, just because it teaches you comedy in a very natural way. It teaches you the importance of being grounded and ideas being, both grounded but also connecting to an audience and taking your truth and making that funny. So improv is just such an incredible art form. And being in various different groups led me to performing in Edinburgh. I performed in New York as well, not just with UCB, but we flew out for a massive festival over there. So I've loved improv. I miss improv, like, massively. But at some point you have to make a decision, right? And you can't be an incredible improviser and an incredible stand-up at the same time. So doing improv had to take a bit of a back seat whilst I focused on stand-up.
So the move into stand-up. So it always interests me when people say they went on a stand-up course. I've spoken to a few.
Yeah.
Actually, it's much more common in recent years. I've spoken to a few comedians who have done that course. But for people who have no idea what that means.
Right.
What does that mean?
That is a good question. Actually, interestingly, I think it more gave me confidence to be on stage rather than it gave me the tools of how to write a joke.
People said that before. Confidence and discipline are possibly the things that the course can give you.
It certainly gave me an idea of different ways of doing things. Like, I'm not sure I've adapted any of those, really, to be honest. I think it's like learning to drive, isn't it? You don't drive properly, you probably wouldn't pass your test. And I think it's a bit like that. It gave me, I'm struggling to even know what it did for me. I think it just gave me the confidence, yeah. And it taught me how to brainstorm something. Like, so now, for example, if I'm trying to write a joke, I'll try and write 10 different versions of a feeling. I'll try and understand where my feeling is coming from, and then eventually I'll find a joke in those. So it taught me some useful tools. Yeah. To find the funny.
And then once you decided stand-up is what you're going to do and you're sort of evolving that creatively and finding opportunities, because I guess, did you then go on that classic stand-up journey of it's sort of like the 5 minute, then a 10 minute, then the club set?
I didn't. And I really feel like a huge imposter every single day.
So you went straight to the hour?
Exact problem. Yes, I did. I literally did, because I was back on the radio at this point and I was more myself and working for radio stations that allowed me to be more me. So I was quite busy, and then I just decided, like, if I don't throw myself into an hour now, I won't like do it in time.
Yeah.
So I just booked a free fringe room in Brighton Fringe and just worked towards doing an hour. But crucially, a third of it was improvised.
Building on your improv.
Absolutely.
Deliberately, wasn't you?
Yeah, it was a deliberate decision. No, I was dating the audience and I took them on a speed date, but sort of improvised with them. So yeah, I would say a third of it was improvised. And of all the jokes in that show, looking back at it now, I think I would only use two in a club set.
Yeah.
So I don't know what that tells you, but I did get, eventually when I brought that show to Edinburgh, I did get good reviews from it. So I worked on it for a very long time and I was really proud of it. But yeah, I didn't really go down the club route, and I've gone backwards actually, and I'm now doing that, and I'm doing fives and tens and twenties and trying to figure out what the best five is and what the best 10 is.
Yes, when you've crafted something which in your mind is, it's like, I guess it's like, you know, you've crafted an album and they want the track, and it's like, well, hang on a second, which is
the track?
Yeah.
And how do you get to the track?
Yeah.
Well, how do people still laugh at it?
Exactly.
If you haven't told them the 40-minute build-up. But yeah, it works. I love club gigs. They're the best place to try out new material by squeezing something in the middle. But I also went even further backwards actually and started doing really, like, really open mics with complete beginners.
Yeah.
Just because I thought I deserved a hard time.
Yeah.
I deserved to bomb because I hadn't done that. So I deliberately went and did some really bad gigs that I had to pay to
to perform.
Wow. Just so I wouldn't feel like an imposter. Yeah. So that I could turn around and be like, yeah, no, I've done the comedy thing. I've done it all. I've been from the I've gone from the bottom to the top.
We went radio, improv, full hour show, and then backwards through all of the other trauma of building a career as a stand-up.
It's crazy,
comedian.
Isn't it? But really, building a career in stand-up now, I think, is a lot to do with TikTok and Instagram. And
100%. That's weird. And even though, you know, well, maybe not TikTok, a lot of those platforms have been around, what, 15 years now. But it does feel it's sort of around about the pandemic was when suddenly it was like, it's not that you do the open mic certain scene and then the 5 minute, 10 minute. It's like you get a massive audience on TikTok. It's like, how the hell do I turn that into something you can
And there's so many brilliantly funny, talented TikTokers and that are now comedians who have done that perfectly. And it's amazing. They've worked so hard to be able to do that. But obviously, it can also be embarrassing, can't it, if someone's got like millions of followers and then you turn up and their show is just not good enough. Luckily, I haven't seen that happen for quite a while now. So I think everyone's getting it.
Learning how to turn your 60-second sketches
into I've been too busy doing bloody radio and stuff. I need to be getting out there more online.
Before we get on to this year's show, let's just quickly talk about the podcast, because that's a really big thing.
Yeah.
So at what point did you jump on that bandwagon? And then I guess, how did you find, because I think with podcasting, there's people like yourself had a huge amount of success with that. And we're seeing ever increasing number of people having success with that. But we also know that there are millions of podcasts that everyone has a podcast now, most of which struggle to find an audience.
Yeah. It came about because in 2013, I didn't want to do radio anymore. And a friend of mine had said, why don't you do a podcast with my boyfriend?
Yeah.
He's not gay. You're gay. It'll be really funny.
And, as our format.
Right. And I didn't want to do it. And we didn't have a name. So in the end, I named it a gay and a non-gay. But it was really hard because I'd never been like out publicly like that. So even just being associated with something gay was quite difficult for me to come to terms with. How ridiculous now. But yeah, we started it not in 2013, I think probably 2015, 16. And it's been going ever since. And yeah, I'm very proud of it. It has a really dedicated audience who are beautiful and keep turning up at my shows and ruining punchlines.
And do you think having done the radio stuff helped in terms of being a podcaster? Or do you think actually being a comedian is more important in having the comedy stuff?
I do not think radio helped. I think perhaps just in terms of how to record, how to edit.
Yeah.
But no, in terms of talent and speaking and communicating, I don't know, maybe. It probably has helped with stand-up too in a way, because I know how to pronounce a word properly or try to tell an audience what I'm thinking. But on the radio, you can make notes and you only speak for 30 seconds. On a stage, you have an hour's worth of material to try and remember. So, it's made up. What am I talking about? It's very difficult. It's very, very different.
Yeah.
But I think the best podcasts are not radio people. So I would never say I think radio helped me, actually, because as I just said, the best, most talented podcasters are not people that have been on the radio.
And I guess, you know, for me...
Fuck the radio, sorry.
Get rid of
radio. No, I'm joking, it pays me money.
But I guess a lot of the podcasts that I really love and have had huge success, it is often the two-person conversation thing, isn't it? And you occasionally get that on radio, particularly in the breakfast show format, but actually most commercial radio, it's not the two-person conversation. And I think that's where you really feel like you get to know the people as friends, because you're sort of listening to them just basically having a conversation every week.
You're just part of their friendship circle. You're in their WhatsApp group.
Yeah.
And actually, the radio show I host now with Fleur East and Matt Haslam is very much like that. It feels like a WhatsApp group energy, and it can very easily be a podcast, but it is on the radio. So, yeah.
Let's bring us to the present now, because we must talk about this year's show.
Yes.
Tell us about this year's show.
Well, it's called James Barr, Sorry I Hurt Your Son, Said My Ex to My Mum. And it's co-directed by Madeline Parry, who co-directed Hannah Gadsby's Netflix special. And Madeline has just been incredible at helping me find my story and having the strength to tell it on stage.
And have you worked with a director like that on previous Edinburgh shows?
I haven't.
So this was a
very different.
And what made you think that this was the show to bring in that other sort of creative mind to help?
I was thinking, and I needed a lifeline. So I just cold emailed her and said, help, basically. I was really struggling because this story is about surviving a violent ex-boyfriend, and it's not something that I think I was even ready to tell days before coming to Edinburgh. But when I decided to try to do this, it was last Edinburgh. It was a year ago, almost now, actually. And I was reading feelings off a piece of paper and crying in a room that smelt of chips at the Free Fringe. And my audiences were amazing. And I think meeting people that had experienced the same thing really powered me forwards. Like, I realized I had to tell the story. But I just couldn't. And I kept rewatching Nanette. And I was like, how is she doing this? And so I made a decision, like, okay, cool, fine. Like, lean into that. Just do that. Don't be Nanette, obviously, but like, allow yourself to tell your version. And I reached out to Madeline. And
so it's literally a cold call.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. And it's been a lot of very late nights and early mornings because Madeline's in Adelaide.
Wow.
So our time difference is enormous. Our first meeting was at 4 a.m. one weekday. So yeah, it's been really interesting. But I've also worked with Dec Monroe, who is in London. He's been offering me some support. And another friend of mine from improv, Chris Gow, has offered me a lot of support. And so it's a real village, to be honest. It's been a lot of teamwork from a lot of different people and friends also who've thrown in jokes here and there or supported me along the way.
And by going through that process, I mean, have you learned something about how you can take, you know, some more sort of serious and traumatic themes and yet still turn it into a comedy show?
My God, yeah. And actually, I feel like I've completely relearned comedy from this experience. And I'm excited about, I mean, this show, I want this show to live forever. It's so important to me personally and the audiences that are seeing it. So yeah, but I keep thinking, like, what am I going to write next? That's going to be so interesting because now I've got all these tools.
Yeah,
because
this time last year you sort of knew.
Yeah, well,
even if you were regretting that all the way up to the start line. By the
this time last year, I thought my comedy was really deep. I thought my comedy was really vulnerable and so important. I was like, so not arrogant, but I was like, oh yeah, this story is really important. People were telling me I was too gay, but that's nothing compared to this. And so yeah, I realized my comedy before, it was probably, I don't think it had any texture. I think it was funny, but I don't think it had that beautiful vulnerability and texture that we see in so many of the great stories of our time. So
yeah, no,
I'm not calling mine that, by the way, although I hope it is.
Well, no, and I think there are certain comedy shows, aren't there, where, you know, there are stand-up shows where in essence they are lots of little 10-minute segments, and therefore it's relatively easy for the comedian to then turn that into doing 10 minutes in club, even if you have the agonizing choice of which bit to use.
Yeah.
But then there are some stand-up shows where it does feel like, no, actually this is in essence, it's funny, it's definitely comedy, but it does feel like I've been on a journey here. There's very much a beginning and a middle and an end.
I don't think my show has a beginning, middle or end, actually. I deliberately constructed it against multiple people's advice in a way that felt abusive because I wanted to show people what abuse feels like. So the show is happy and silly and then sad and then happy and silly and sad and then happy again and then sad again. And I really wanted to show you
the up and the down,
the ups and the downs of trusting someone and then not trusting them.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I really saw that in stand-up a lot. Because if you've been in an abusive situation, you see abuse everywhere anyway. I get annoyed at Wagamama when the meals come out separately. I'm like, why? I order online, they all come together. Why you just hold them? Why are you lying to me? And I was getting very triggered by everything. And watching stand-up was really triggering because I was seeing these comedians lying to their audience for a punchline. And it was really pissing me off watching it because I was triggered just by my own experience. And so I saw that and I realized, oh, this is exactly the right place for a story like this because stand-up is almost a bit of gaslighting. Like, there is some abuse in it. And I'm not saying it is abuse. Obviously, it's not. But there's some stuff in there that has the same rhythm. It sort of permeates that safety and unsafety.
That's really interesting, isn't it? And the idea of almost the abuser in that scenario, in essence, is kind of putting on a performance.
Yeah,
half
I mean,
the time.
The first part of my show is deliberately written to be, these are my words, silly, stupid, not particularly groundbreaking, like dick jokes, very gay, like what you would expect probably from me if you'd come 3 years ago. It's that. And to be honest, like part of me is a bit like, oh, this beginning is a bit like I feel like it's the difference between a 4 and a 5 star. Or, yeah. Like, if you were just noting that bit, you'd probably be like, yeah. Oh yeah, it was fine, 3 stars. But I've done that deliberately because I need the audience to feel safe. I'm trying to lie to them almost. I'm trying to be like, welcome to the party. I'm a slut, let's go.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, oh, actually, we're here to talk about abuse.
Yeah. And so, yes. And
but a performer, every performer does that, I think. There's always a level of like deceit going on, isn't there? Because it's magic, stand-up comedy. It's a magic trick, ultimately.
So you sort of said almost up to the festival starting, you were still very nervous, I guess, about fulfilling this commitment you made a year ago. So we are now, I guess we're past halfway, aren't we? So how are you feeling now that we are 12, 13 performances in?
I feel very proud of myself.
Yeah.
And the reviews that people have written or come up to me and said after the show in real life, I mean, audience members have just been so affirming and powerful. I had a message saying, thank you for writing this life-saving show, and I burst into tears immediately. So I think that I'm feeling very proud, and my inner child and my soul all feel very like at peace.
Yeah.
But I'm also, my narcissist is crazy, is like going mad, getting upset about things or thinking too far ahead and worrying that it's not making a difference or that I potentially ruin my career by doing it. So I'm struggling with that a little bit, but I'm just trying to stay grounded and stay true to my gut.
So if we move finally on to the future, so let's talk about the future for this show. Mm. So I guess it is a show which really needs to be performed in its whole for the reasons you described. So is the plan to take this on? And I guess, could you see it being, is the 55, 60 minute format perfect, or could it become a longer piece? What are you thinking?
I definitely think it could change. I sort of wanted to do that here, but I haven't found the time. And honestly, it's emotionally so stressful to do that. I think the fact that it's in such a good place makes me not want to change it too much. But I do want to loosen up a little bit with it. I definitely think so. I mean, I had so much material I couldn't put into it. At one point, it was probably 2 hours long and I had to really cut it down. So yeah, there's a lot more that I want to do with it. I do want it to be longer. I would like it to be a special. And I think, I think there's definitely room for improvement to be able to make that happen. But yeah, I think the structure of the show and the emotional beats and the truth, it's just so important that I want as many people to hear it as possible.
And then beyond this particular show, so I guess at the moment you are balancing, you're doing the radio work again. Obviously, you've got the podcast, that's a big part of what you do, and the stand-up and the show. So, I mean, do you enjoy having those three different sides to what you do? And do you see yourself focusing on one of those, or is the variety very much the plan for the immediate future?
I really want to focus on stand-up. I want to tour this show. I want to give this show and this message the best shot it's got to make as big an impact as possible for people like me who didn't see these stories, and also so that people take accountability for being abusive fucks. So yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure how to answer that. I do enjoy all of the different things I do, but at some point I think you do have to decide which is the most important.
I guess you're a stand-up comedian who does radio and podcasts.
Well, it's probably the other way around, isn't it? I'm a radio host that does stand-up.
I suppose it has, yes.
Does stand-up. And so, yeah, I'm going backwards. I've got the radio thing sorted that a lot of comedians would absolutely love to do.
Yeah, and to have a podcast. You know,
I've got this
podcast.
Daily beast of a radio show that's amazing. Yeah. I'm really happy to be on it. I don't want to go anywhere. But then also I've got the stand-up career and early morning breakfast shows and stand-up. comedy in the evening. They don't really go together very well. So we'll see what happens. But I'm very open to what the universe wants to send me. That sounds very arty, doesn't it? So we'll see but I do believe that I'm in the right place.
So let's
finish. And that things will fall together in the right order. I don't know what I'm saying.
With the Edinburgh listings for people to see the show in its current iteration before the end of the festival. When, where?
Yes. Well, it's on Underbelly, Bristow Square, 5:15 p.m. James Barr, Sorry I Hurt Your Son, Said My Ex to My Mum, longest title ever. And I'm also doing a London date on the 15th of September. And you can get tickets and find out more information at jamesbarcomedy.com.
Awesome. Thank you very much for talking.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
It's been great.